Welcome to Life in Debt, the Practical Debt Education Program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. You can get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the New York Times, New York State has first deficit in general fund in its history. For the first time in history, New York's main bank account is poised to end the year in the red. New York has a negative balance of $174 million in its general fund, with nearly $1 billion in bills owed by day's end. To fill the gap, New York will be forced to rely on raiding its short-term investment pool. But that account itself is dangerously low, with only about $800 million on hand, compared with a balance in more flush years of as much as $16 billion. And the lower the short-term balance falls, the harder it is for the state to cover its day-to-day bills, and the closer New York moves towards a previously unimaginable eventuality, a government check that bounces. No problem, just write IOUs. And also from the New York Times, how board members of Fannie and Countrywide escaped liability. Fair game? What iceberg? Just glide to the next boardroom. This is by Gretchen Morgenson. You might think that board members overseeing businesses that cratered in the credit crisis would be disqualified from serving as directors at other public companies. You would, however, be wrong. Directors who were supposedly minding the store as disaster struck at companies like Countrywide Financial, Washington Mutual, or Fannie Mae have not all been banished from other boardrooms. In many cases, directors just seem to skate away from the company woes that occurred on their watch. To some investors, this is an example of the refusal of those involved in the debacle to accept responsibility for it. Whether you are talking about top executives loading up on leverage, regulators who slept while companies took on titanic risks, or mortgage lenders that made thousands of dubious loans, few in this crowd have acknowledged culpability. Taxpayers and shareholders, meanwhile, who had nothing to do with the problems, are left holding the bag. None of these directors have stood up and said, "We made a mistake here by not calling management to account," said Paul Hodgson, senior research associate at the Corporate Library, a corporate governance research firm. They have certainly avoided the limelight as far as blame is concerned. Moreover, they continue to get work as directors at other companies. Three large public companies provide excellent examples. They are Sunoco, the oil company, PACCAR Inc., a truck manufacturer, and Tetra Tech Inc., a management consulting and technical services concern. Each of these companies has two directors who, until recently, were on the boards of institutions that were centrally involved in the mortgage meltdown. Ms. Morgenson, then in her article, goes into detail on who went where in these three companies and continues, "This is not to say that these directors are not performing their duties. Indeed, some would argue that directors who have witnessed at close range the collapse of a company may learn a great deal from that experience and bring to their boardroom an increased sense of responsibility. But it is hard to blame shareholders for wondering whose side directors are on, given the broad failures by many board members to recognize and rein in risk-taking at so many companies." as fiduciaries for the owners of the companies on whose boards they serve, directors have a duty to act in shareholders' interests. After all, they are the shareholders' representatives, and they are charged with ensuring that their companies are operated soundly and with long-term profitability in mind. Yet it doesn't always seem to work out that way. Frederick E. Rowe, president of Investors for Director Accountability, a nonprofit shareholder advocacy group, said, "Here's a conversation you'll never hear. Yes, I get paid $475,000 a year. I play golf with the CEO. He's a personal friend. I go to interesting places for board meetings. I am around interesting people, and I would never say one word that would jeopardize my position on the board." The main reason for director dysfunction is that board members have little fear of being fired for incompetence or sleepwalking through meetings. Because the way director elections are structured, board members can win their seats if they receive just one vote of support. And even if a majority of shareholders withhold support from directors at annual elections, the directors who are singled out are often allowed to stay. And shareholders interested in ousting a director or two must mount an expensive proxy fight to do so. There is a movement afoot to change this arrangement. The Securities and Exchange Commission has proposed new rules that would give large shareholders a way to replace incompetent directors with their own nominees. 2 weeks ago, the SEC reopened its comment period for these rule changes. But the proposal has too many limitations, shareholder advocates say. For example, only those who have owned a stock for 1 year and who hold a stake of at least 1% in a big company may have their director nominees included in a company's proxy materials and submitted to a shareholder vote. "It's a step forward, but a pretty embarrassingly baby step," said John Gillespie, a former investment banker who, with David Zweig, is co-author of Money for Nothing, a forthcoming book on board failures. "The bigger problem is the culture of boards, which doesn't allow directors to do an effective job even if they wanted to." Solutions to the culture problem, he said, would include instituting term limits for directors in order to keep fresh blood circulating on a board and separating the roles of board chairman and chief executive. "Most important," Mr. Gillespie said, "United States shareholder groups holding 10% stakes in companies should have the right, as they do in Britain and other countries, to call special meetings. Then and there, they could jettison directors who are seen as not doing their jobs." The reality of our human nature is to pay more attention to people who can fire you than to those who can't, Mr. Rowe said. Even though the stock market has performed well this year, Mr. Hodgson of the Corporate Library says he thinks that many directors will face significant opposition, albeit still toothless, from shareholders at annual elections in 2010. "I think we are going to see some of the highest levels of either no votes, where companies have a democratic process, or withhold votes," he said. "People were at fault there, and saying that nobody could have predicted it is not an excuse. If you are on the board, you have the responsibility to find those things out and not just believe what management is telling you." And from Reuters, if you weren't familiar with the name Ponzi last year, you sure learned it quickly this year, along with the names Madoff, Dreyer, Peters, and all the others who followed in the footsteps of the notorious fraudster Charles Ponzi. That's because, as the Associated Press reports, the number of Ponzi schemes that came to light in the U.S. has nearly quadrupled in the last year. The schemes, in which perpetrators lure investors with promises of high returns and use new investors' cash to pay the old ones, and of course grab cash for themselves, topped 150 this year, compared to about 40 last year. As a result, the AP says tens of thousands of investors lost more than $16.5 billion this year. That figure doesn't include the $19.4 billion that Bernard Madoff is estimated to have bilked his investors out of in the largest Ponzi scheme ever, because Madoff was arrested in December of 2008.
The AP's review of federal and state criminal cases found that amid the recession and heightened public awareness of Ponzi schemes, the federal government stepped up pursuit of suspected fraudsters. The Federal Bureau of Investigation launched more than 2,100 probes into securities fraud, up from last year's 1,750 investigations, and it increased by one-third the number of agents working on high-yield investment fraud cases. The Securities and Exchange Commission has issued 82% more restraining orders and devoted more of its workload to investigating scams. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now I'd like to continue teaching the concepts of the two-income trap by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's greatest scholars in the area of debt. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on their work, theories, and books. I highly recommend their books, All You're Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the programs which have been presented on the various issues regarding debt, how to deal with it, and basically how to take control of your financial life. Last week, I was discussing the issue of the cost people have from needing a second vehicle because now there are two people working in the family, and concluded that by and large, families have spent prudently on their automobiles, or at least as prudently as they did a generation ago. Statistically, the money they are spending is paying off. The rate of child auto fatalities has declined steadily since the mid-1970s, thanks in part to safer cars and better car seats, and also that the cars do last a lot longer than they used to. And we looked at families then and families now under the two-income trap. We tried to add it all up. Families are working harder, and thanks to mom's income, they are making more money than ever before. But they are spending more money too. So where does that leave the typical working family? Professor Warren offered two examples, Tom and Susan representing the average middle-class family of a generation ago. And of course, when we use these numbers, all the figures are adjusted for inflation. Looking at turn-of-the-century dollars in comparison to the 1970s dollars. So in the example, Tom works full-time earning $38,700, the median income for a fully employed man in 1973, while Susan stays at home to care for the house and the children. Tom and Susan have the typical two-child, one in grade school, and a three-year-old who stays at home. In the example, the family buys health insurance through Tom's job, to which they contribute $1,030 a year, which is the average amount spent by an insured family that made at least some contribution to the cost of private insurance policies. They own an average home in an average family neighborhood, costing about $5,310 a year in mortgage payments. Shopping is within walking distance, so the family owns just one car, on which it spends $5,140 a year for car payments, maintenance, gas, and repairs. And like all good citizens, they pay their taxes, which claim about 24% of Tom's income. Again, this is in 1973. Once all the taxes, mortgage payments, and other fixed expenses are paid, Tom and Susan are left with $17,834 in discretionary income, inflation adjusted, or about 46% of Tom's pre-tax check. They're not rich. They have the typical middle class setup with nearly $1,500 a month to cover food, clothing, utilities, and anything else they might need or want. Then Professor Warren goes on to compare Tom and Susan with Justin and Kimberly, which is the modern-day version of the traditional family. Justin is an average earner, bringing home about $39,000 in the year 2000. And by way of comparison, in 2010 in Iowa, the average of a worker is just a little over $40,000, so not a great difference there either. But in her example, there is one big difference. Thanks to Kimberly's full-time salary, the family's combined income is $67,800, a whopping 75% increase over the income for the household of Tom and Susan. So a quick look at their income statement shows how the modern dual-income couple has really sailed past their single-income counterpart of a generation ago. So where does all the money go? Like Tom and Susan, Justin and Kimberly bought an average home, but today the three-bedroom, two-bath ranch costs a lot more. Their annual mortgage payments are nearly $9,000 a year rather than the $5,300 a year. Their older child still goes to public elementary school, but after school and during summer vacations, he goes to a daycare center at an average yearly cost of $4,350. The younger child attends a full-time preschool daycare program, which costs the family $5,320 a year, according to the data. With Kimberly at work, the second car is a must, so the family spends more than $8,000 a year on its two vehicles. Health insurance is another must, and even with Justin's employer picking up a big share of the cost, insurance takes $1,650 from the couple's paychecks. And taxes also take their toll. Now think about it. Thanks in part to Kimberly's extra income, the family has been bumped into a higher tax bracket, and the government now takes 33% of the family's income. So we do all the computation, and where does that leave Justin and Kimberly after these basic expenses are deducted? With $17,045. Comparing that to Tom and Susan from 1973, that's $800 less, even though two people are working at the turn of the century. All of this bears some repeating. Today, an average two-income family makes its house payments, car payments, insurance payments, and child care payments, but they have less money left over, even though they have a second full-time earner in the workplace. If that's the case, then, where the two-income family has less money left over than the one-income family of the 70s, what happens to a family that tries to get by on a single income in today's economy? Their expenses would be a little lower than the two-income family because they can save on after-school care for the older child, their taxes will be lower, and if they are lucky, they live close enough to shopping and other services and can go without a second car. But if they try to live a normal middle-class life in other ways, buy an average home, send their younger child to preschool, purchase health insurance, and so forth, they would be left with only $6,720 a year to cover all of their other expenses. They'd have to find a way to buy food, clothing, utilities, life insurance, furniture, appliances, and so on with less than $600 a month. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been comparing the family with a single wage earner in 1973 with the family that has two wage earners at the turn of the century and who is in the two-income trap, and how the economy has adjusted. We concluded that, in fact, all the basic substantial issues considered, the family in the two-income position is actually worse off because they have less money. And then we were considering, what about the family that still has one person earning and the other person at home with the kids? When we compare the numbers, the modern single earner family that tries to keep up an average lifestyle faces a 60% drop in discretionary income compared with its one income counterpart of a generation ago. So even to those who criticize and say selfish mothers should return home, Professor Warren's responses are, "You kidding? Just do the math." And for all the advocates of downshifting, we are asking just how far down these families are supposed to shift. As an aside, we have to be clear that these are examples, that the expenses laid out are averages, and plenty of families manage to pay less or more. But the alternatives families have pursued in an effort to make ends meet bear some scrutiny. Just consider childcare. Government statistics show that the average amount a family of four spends on after-school care is lower than the $4,350 cited. Professor Warren calculated her figures from data on families who pay for childcare, but the government average includes children who have a grandmother or an older sibling who watches them for free. That's a great way for those lucky families to save some money, but it doesn't do a bit of good for the typical family that has to rely on paid childcare. For them, paying less money means getting less quality, such as an unlicensed neighbor who parks several children in front of her television, or an overcrowded center with barely passable facilities. There are other ways families could save money. Families also cut their health insurance expenses. They could drop those costs to zero by following the model of millions of other middle-class families who simply live without health insurance and pray for the best. Or they could give up the house and move into an apartment in a marginal neighborhood. So there are always options, but for families with children, these options signal that their middle-class lives are slipping away. Professor Warren points out that even if they are able to trim around the edges, families are faced with a sobering truth. Every one of those expensive items we identified, mortgage, car payments, insurance, tuition, is a fixed cost. And that is in the sense that families must pay them each and every month through good times and bad times, no matter what. And this doesn't even take into consideration the adjustable rate mortgage dilemma that millions and millions of families have found themselves embroiled in, with the resultant foreclosures that are happening. Unlike clothing or food, there's no way to cut back from one month to the next month on the mortgage, car payments, insurance, and tuition. They're set, yet do find themselves going up with respect to mortgage and insurance payments in the last few years. Short of moving out of the house, withdrawing their children from preschool, or canceling the insurance policy altogether, the modern couple are stuck. Fully 75% of the couple's income is earmarked for recurrent monthly expenses. If all goes well, that couple may squeak by. They will even get a breather in another 5 years or so when the children are old enough to be left alone after school. But the spending hiatus will last for just a few years until the older child heads off to college, which we spoke about in past shows. At that point, the family's budget will be squeezed harder than ever as they search for an extra $9,000 a year to cover room, board, and tuition for the local state university. If they are lucky, they will have set something aside during the intervening years, and they will find a way to put their kids through college. And when they hit their mid to late 50s, that couple might begin to think about putting something away for their retirement, which is about 30 years later than a financial planner would recommend. As an aside, we also discuss the college student loans and the dilemma with that, so you can go back to former shows and listen to those issues. But even in this current kind of example, the projection assumes, of course, that nothing goes wrong. With 75% of the income marked for fixed expenses, today's family has no margin for error. There's no leeway to cut back if the husband's hours are cut or if the wife gets laid off or vice versa. There is no room in the budget if one of the working parents needs to take a few months off work to care for a grandparent or parent, or if one of them gets hurt while at work and can't work. So the American family is walking on a high wire without a net. And they pray that there won't be any wind. If all goes well, they will make it across safely. Their children will grow up and finish college, and they will move on to retirement. But if anything at all goes wrong, then today's two-income family is in big, big trouble. So we'll start on exploring just how much can go wrong.
So let's jump into the concept of MOM, the all-purpose safety net, and we'll start with a story. Carmen's third pregnancy was difficult. When she was 30 weeks along, she started hemorrhaging and her obstetrician performed an emergency cesarean section. Little Gabe weighed just under 2 pounds at birth, and the doctors predicted a lifetime of severely impaired physical and cognitive ability for him. Many would have considered Gabe's fate a tragedy, but Carmen saw it differently. "This was God's gift. He is my miracle baby," she said. "He came when my sister suddenly passed away. I could not believe I was pregnant. I felt so blessed." Months later, Gabe still needed the support of a machine to breathe. He was a quiet baby who rarely fussed, but Carmen checked on him constantly. One evening, after putting Gabe to bed, Carmen started to fix dinner for her two older children. The macaroni had just started boiling when she left the kitchen abruptly and ran to the baby's room. "I don't know why, but I just needed to check again." She was confronted by a terrifying silence. Her heart began to race. "He aspirated. I had to do CPR on him." Gabe survived, and over the next 3 years he made some advances, but his progress was slow. Carmen explains that at age 3, he can't really walk or talk yet. He's still on the bottle, and he's now just starting to eat table food. "We have to make sure it's chopped up and real fine. He could choke. He screams incessantly when he is anxious, which presents a particular challenge because he still needs so much medical attention. He's traumatized by doctors. He's traumatized by nurses because of being stuck and probed. He knows the uniforms." Carmen had gone back to her job as a lab technician shortly after the birth of each of their other two children, but it didn't occur to either Carmen or her husband, Mike, that she could leave this baby. "People are afraid to keep him because of him being delicate, which made childcare impossible to arrange. Even family members were reluctant to look after Gabe. My mother-in-law was afraid to take him because of his condition. If I had her to watch him, I had to be back in an hour." When Gabe was first born, Carmen had arranged a leave of absence from her job, but when the leave ran out, she said, "I just resigned." She pauses and says hopefully, "but just until he's better." Like many other couples, Carmen and Mike ultimately had to file for bankruptcy. The reason? Not the one their friends might guess, the staggering expense of tending to Gabe's medical needs. That is not to say that Gabe's care was inexpensive. Gabe is well on his way to becoming a million-dollar baby. So next week, we'll go into some of the reasons for this situation. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. From Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.